Our next speaker will be Dr. C.J. Mumford. He's a professor of history and political economy at the University of Guelph in Canada. He's also taught at the University of Nigeria. He's the author of Production Relations, Class, and Black Liberation, A Marxist Perspective in African American Studies.
Morning. What I'm going to attempt to do is to set out for you a Malcolm-inspired agenda for the 1990s. In order to be as concise as possible in the short span allotted to me, I shall offer my presentation in the form of 8 theses. Quite obviously, they are not fully elaborated. They are presented for discussion. Thesis number 1, the political economy of the United States, or as we often informally and inexactly call it, the system, is rooted in racist relations of production. This is the case today and has always been so in the past. From its birth, U.S. capitalism was nurtured on the unpaid forced labor of black slaves. Following the Civil War, the Jim Crow sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and convict lease laborers. Early in this century, once the flow of cheap white European immigrant labor began to sputter, the system transferred a large portion of the black community to urban ghettos and fostered the growth of a super exploited proletariat in the inner cities. Today, the U.S. political economy stands in indecision at a crossroads. It is unable to decide, systemically unable to decide, whether there is any further use to which the labor of a huge portion of black America can be put that is compatible with white profit maximization. This malaise, this anxiety, is bound to worsen in coming years as renewed contradictions build up between U.S. imperialism on one side and its Japanese and European antagonists on the other. Among the present day, not exclusive, but among the present day effects of racist relations of production, are growing marginalization, economic exclusion, lifelong unemployment for some of us, and for others, relegation to an illegal parallel economy of drug dealing and such like. The main victims are young black males. If the syndrome is not rectified, the prospect for them, for young black males, over the next several generations is one of recurrent cycles of deliberate undereducation, no education at all, or the informal training of the streets. Increasingly, they are left with the bleak options of jail, treadmill-like containment in the inner cities, or a specious so-called volunteer service in the armed forces, where they are given the golden opportunity to shed their blood stomping third world people. This is what the armed forces will mean for black enlisted men now that the white, European, former socialist countries have thrown in the towel. The white so-called socialist second world has surrendered, folded its tents, and enlisted as eager and enthralled junior partners in the racist capitalist first world, a first world that hitherto has been made up of NATO-ized advanced industrial countries. This has opened the door to increased oppression of people of color around the globe. However, since it reflects a systemic indecision, the marginalization of our people in this country is unstable and temporary. The system's inability to deal with black people on equal and just terms is genetically encoded, as it were, and above all, it is historically rooted. There is a growing suspicion in the corridors of white power that no further accommodation can be reached with black America that would confirm the social status quo and be profitable to white capitalism. Bush's veto of the 1990 civil rights legislation bears witness to this fact. Of course, this systemic hesitation is extremely dangerous for us, for it is encouraging white supremacy think tankers to toy with all sorts of dreadful options, everything from sophisticated high-tech Bantustanization wrapped in the colors of old glory to schemes of genocide and deportation. All of these phenomena threaten the very life of the black community. They spring from economic changes and the scientific technological revolution which require a radical restructuring of capitalism. Thesis number two. For many people on the left, the recent political changes around the world have released the straitjacket of so-called orthodox formulations. There is greater stimulus to state openly that which many of us have known for a long time. That is that Karl Marx, admittedly a great thinker, nevertheless erred. He was mistaken in crowning the white working class as the world historical agent of revolution. If this prediction was ever accurate, it was right only for a very short time. For shortly after 1917, the white working class lost its revolutionary vocation, if it ever had one. The center of revolutionary gravity has long since shifted away from the dead-end so-called East-West conflict to the oppressed peoples of the Third World, that is, to the South, in what is now termed the North-South axis, that is, to people of color in both Third World and imperialist countries. What Marx seems to have overlooked in regard to white workers was his own dictum. His dictum that the ideas that rule the behavior of most rank and file working class whites were and are the ideas of the ruling class. And those ideas are racist. Even if many no longer believe that blacks are outright inferior, far too many white wage earners and their families still regard black people as some sort of aliens to be shunned. The victory of counter-revolution in all the formerly socialist countries of Eastern Europe reveals that retrograde, racist, neo-fascist principles are deeply popular among the white masses everywhere. Even the Parliament of the European Community has had to admit recently that a wave of white racism is sweeping Western Europe. Recent electoral and polling data from locales like Chicago and Detroit indicate that working class whites are more apt than middle class whites to embrace racist demagogues. This actually continues a tradition going back to the bloody, anti-black, white race riots earlier in the century. Thus, we must be on guard that talk of so-called, quote, anti-racist majorities does not lull us to sleep. Take the David Duke phenomena. Here we have a former Ku Kluxer born again as the messiah of anti-affirmative action politicians. Forget about all the feel-good hype about the presence of an alleged anti-racist majority in the so-called New South. Duke's grand slams show bedrock contempt for black people. What else can his polling 44% of the popular vote in the recent senatorial primary election in Louisiana mean? Keep in mind that he garnered all those votes, even though all the black folks who bothered to cast a ballot voted against him. And 28% of the eligible voters in Louisiana are African Americans. What does that tell us about white grassroots support for this old-time race hater? I think it tells us that when push comes to shove, the attitude of white folks to African Americans in the Louisiana of 1990 is not so unlike that hatred which in 1900 mobilized a New Orleans lynch mob of 20,000 to hunt down Brother Robert Charles, one of the proudest black martyrs in American history. Is Louisiana merely an aberration? Or is the situation similar in the rest of the country? A similar message seems to be coming even from the so-called liberal Northeast, where the arch-conservative John Silber can jump 15 percentage points in the polls and win the Massachusetts Democratic Party gubernatorial nomination as rewards for writing off the black community as a, quote, bunch of drug addicts. We are faced with systematic harassment of black elected officials by law enforcement agencies and the media. We are faced with the federal government's Frumenschen, good German word, Frumenschen doctrine, which says that our leaders are brainless, irresponsible primitives. Thus, again, one feels the strength of Malcolm's warning to be on the alert, to be vigilant, to be self-reliant. Thesis number three. Now, the first and overriding concern of every black person must be for his or her personal safety. All considerations of class affinity aside. Thus, the ongoing physical attacks on African Americans who, quote, stray into so-called white neighborhoods must put frank and vigorous condemnation of white working class racism high on the agenda for all left-wing activists who say they are sincere about forming alliances and rainbow coalitions with black Americans. If they wish to win any kind of credibility with us, they must cease psychoanalyzing white working class racists. They must cease excusing them by throwing the blame on the ruling class. They must cease excusing them by blaming it all on a lack of education and on the so-called frustrations of white workers. They must come out and condemn these thugs for what they are, the enemies of black people. So what if they are white workers? The Marxist among us must face up to the fact that white, blue-collar racism is just plain old racism. This is a very dangerous time for us. However, this situation cannot last much beyond the year 2000. For the logic of contemporary American political economy dictates an imminent solution. It can be a solution that could be fatal for Black America, or it can be a solution that will result in our salvation as a people. In the historical systems of social production through which America has passed, Black people have always been forced into a relation to the means of production that has ever been at once inferior and subordinate to white people. Until very recently, this inferior status was fixed and formulated in law. It no longer is, but the essential position is unaltered. Viewed from this angle, and despite our obvious internal fractionalizations which have evolved over the years, viewed from this angle, Black people as a whole in America constitute one single class in American political economy. They form a class whose role in the social organization of labor, and consequently whose share of the social wealth, has always been prescribed by skin color, prescribed by race. This is what we mean by racial relations of production. Thesis number four. The slogan, equality of opportunity, is spurious. It is a trick designed to confuse Black people and lead them to believe that some kind of level playing ground has been created upon which the mass of African Americans can play on equal terms. It is intended to make us think that ordinary Black people have just as much going for them as white Americans in the pursuit of happiness rat race. The so-called equality of opportunity is contrived to blind us to the huge obstacle of more than 200 years of the United States' peculiar racist history, a history that has heaped up a mountain of handicaps for Black Americans. The job that Malcolm encountered in the 1950s and 1960s had different buzzwords, but he never fell for any of the racist sublimates. He never fell for any of the racist codes, no matter how sophisticated. He knew that the equality of opportunity hype was merely a spur for those of our people caught up in the tokenism race. And were he alive today, I am certain that Malcolm would lead us in insisting instead on the demand for equality of results. Number five. Thus, any Malcolm-inspired agenda must recognize that in each and every social issue, there exists a specific Black interest, a Black interest which must be discerned, articulated, expressed, and insisted upon. The Black interest must never be subsumed under, postponed, shelved, or otherwise subordinated to general white so-called mainstream concerns. For instance, like middle-class feminism, for instance, like lily-white environmental problems, for instance, like the now concern with the emphasis on the Gulf crisis. Nor is it the general Black interest, the Black interest, to take second place to the interest of real or potential political allies, such as white organized labor, such as the peace movement, and other such forces. Not even for the sake of harmonizing a so-called united front strategy. The Black interests must have top priority at the head of the political agenda of the 1990s and early 21st century. To insist on this is to update and secularize Malcolm X's vision of black autonomy. He told us to take hold of our lives and to establish control over our own communities. There is an overriding general black interest, as well as specific black interests, which vary according to issue and happenstance. The general interest must be allowed to exercise a kind of determining veto, as it were, over all black strategy and tactics. Why? Continuing white racism all around the globe is the objective, material basis for the general black interest. In this country, the general black interest is rooted in the racist production relations which continue to mar the nation's political economy. There is a general black interest also because, as Garvey, Dubois, Malcolm explained, neocolonialist imperialism has integrated Africa in the capitalist world economy on the most degraded and super exploited terms. This general black interest is an all-class interest. It should not be nullified by the fact that the contingent interests of the different classes and social strata, that make up the community sometimes diverge and cause disunity. The specific worries of black workers, government employees, businessmen, professionals, and others are partial concerns. Institutionalized white racism blankets every black person in this country to one degree or another. Its influence conditions the life chances of every black individual from the cradle to the grave, at least indirectly. Thus, Malcolm's censure of those he termed house Negroes was not a class-specific put-down. It was not aimed at the black bourgeoisie as such. Rather, he was pointing the finger at traitors and Uncle Toms from all strata of our community. Now, two more theses. One has to do with our demand for reparations. The other has to do with neo-Pan-Africanism. I guess I must cut it off. Number six. Any Malcolm-inspired agenda must begin with the demand for reparations. Fannie Lou Hamer raised this claim in Atlantic City in 1964 at the Democratic Convention, but we've let it slip away. The historical justification for reparations are the four centuries of slave trading and plantation slavery which inflicted untold damage on Africa and on blacks of the diaspora, and which created the basis for the wealth that whites enjoy in the Western Hemisphere. The principle of reparations is enshrined in international law. For instance, at the Potsdam Conference, the United States government explicitly endorsed the collection of reparations in occupied Germany at the end of the Second World War. Furthermore, Germany was pressured to compensate Israel for the Nazi genocide against Jews. Where then is the justice that would deny the bill owed by the United States and white Europe to ravage Africa and African Americans, victims of the most long drawn out genocide and crimes against humanity in modern history? The demand for reparations for black people is a radical one. It is revolutionary in the world historical sense. The demand is also roomy enough to accommodate contingent affirmative actions like, say, an urban Marshall Plan funded from the potential peace dividend, or like, say, the Congressional Black Caucus's alternative quality of life budget, as well as measures to effect them, like the proposed black third party presidential campaign. Reparations for black people like all great ideas whose historical hour has struck, this slogan, if repeated forcefully, will eventually take hold of the public. No matter how vilified and scorned and disregarded, no matter how ridiculed, rejected, and refuted, it is bound in time to capture the imagination of millions. Socioeconomic development has prepared the ground for it. This will come to pass because people at large will grow increasingly frustrated at the spreading rot in the country, and because racism and the oppression of black people remain the sum of all villainies in America, and their abolition is the first essential. We'll skip that one, and then we'll go right to 8, which is in discussion. The definition of reparations as recuperation of wages unpaid during slavery, plus compounded interest, of course. Today, any Malcolm-inspired agenda must include neo-Pan-Africanism. The premise for this is the diaspora of peoples of African descent throughout the Western Hemisphere. Now look, over the next few decades, pressures will build for the formation of a united Europe, confounding NATO-Western Europe with former Soviet bloc Eastern Europe in a white super-colossus. Meanwhile, North America north of Mexico is well on its way to becoming it too a single uniform bastion of white civilization. For instance, the free trade mechanism is now feeding Canada into the United States maw. The Gulf crisis shows that we are entering a period of accelerated recolonization of the third world. The United Nations is being transformed back into a tool for joint imperialism and global white supremacy it once was back in the period from 1947 to 1953. Collective imperialism is poised to impose a new doctrine of impaired or limited sovereignty on African, Latin American, and Middle Eastern countries. Now, given these trends, it would be fatal for Africa to remain politically and economically fragmented and downtrodden. In order to survive, the mother continent must draw together. Africa's emergence as one of the world's great powers is an essential condition for the respect, protection, and dignity of black people living outside Africa. Its unity and appropriate modernization are vital, and that justifies the revival of Pan-Africanism, of a neo-Pan-Africanism. However, history has delivered its verdict. The Americas are the home of diaspora blacks, and we mean to stay here. Therefore, 21st century neo-Pan-Africanism will be no back to Africa movement. Nevertheless, of course, we can be certain that Afro-Americans will never be nurtured, never admired, never treated as equals, so long as Africa itself is starving, diseased, prey to apartheid, disunited, and militarily prostrate. Our fate is tied to that of Africa. From our homes here in the Americas, we ourselves and our children and our grandchildren must lend whatever political, moral, and material aid we can to help raise Africa to full membership in the exclusive club of the world's great power. When I say great powers, I mean including military might. This rendition of neo-Pan-Africanism is how, I think, a 1990 version of Malcolm's Organization of Afro-American Unity might translate in its international aspect. Thank you for being so patient.